So tonight, you have come to hear me talk about the good work of loving words, thoughts on the human call to steward language. I'm not sure what brought you here tonight, but about this topic of loving words and caring for language appeals to you. But I thought I'd begin by telling you a little bit about why I wanted to offer a lecture on this topic. I don't know when it began, but from a very early age, I loved stories, and then plays, and then poems, and I loved that words made these things, and that these things made something in me each time I read or saw them, a world, a time, characters who became friends, and moments where right now and forever intersected. And I loved that I, too, could make with words. In fact, I think I loved this most, the creative potential of speech and of the page, the function of language that George Steiner calls, listen closely, the communication of the quick of the human spirit, which we call grace. And I love those words, too, that phrase, and all that is simultaneously transparent and opaque to me in it. The quick of the human spirit. Quick here is a noun, as in the soft, tender flesh below the growing part of a fingernail or a toenail. The soft, tender flesh of the human spirit communicated. We call this grace. And so when I'm not working on Libri lectures or making lentil soup or proofing loaves of bread or changing diapers or playing Legos or maybe getting out for a walk, and sometimes even in the midst of these things, in grace moments, I think about writing poems. And sometimes I do write them. And because I write them and I want to write them, I want to think about words any chance that I have. So that is one reason I'm offering you this lecture tonight. Another reason is because this summer I read a book called Caring for Words in a Culture of Lies. And it's by Marilyn Chandler McIntyre, who was formerly an English professor at Westmont College and is now a professor of medical humanities at the UC Berkeley-UCSF Joint Medical Program. And in the introductory chapter of her book, McIntyre writes, "The generation of students coming through high school and universities now expects to be lied to. They know about spin and about the profiteering agendas of corporate advertising. They have grown used to the flippant, incessantly ironic banter that passes for conversation and avoid positive claims by verbal backpedaling, like before every clause that might threaten to make a distinction one might argue with, and whatever after approximations that never reach solid declarative ground." But this is what stops me in my tracks. They expect to be lied to. And it stopped me not only because it struck me as frightfully accurate, an accurate description of the generation of students coming through high school and universities, but it struck me as frightfully accurate for me. I expect to be lied to. And it's this expectation, I think, that can fuel cynicism, or at least ambivalence, toward any effort to care for words, to love words. But for one shaped by the words of the Bible, it should come as no surprise that we are lied to. In fact, I think one of the central human tasks for all time has been to discern truth-telling from deceit. In the face of a statement like this, they expect to be lied to. I want to be more motivated to find lively and life-giving ways of using words and to go deeper in my understanding of what language is and is meant to do and how I might love it well. And the other motivations for giving this lecture are responses to present realities that you know well. We're surrounded by words. They are to be seen and heard everywhere, on our little handheld screens, on billboards where they flash and change to the peril of drivers, the ubiquitous television, radio, and a historically unprecedented avalanche of print. Everywhere, words. Because silence is so rare, we need more than ever to know how to navigate our wordy world and bring a little silence back into it, because silence, too, is essential to caring for words. And we live a fairly wordy life here at LaBrie. And Marilyn McIntyre notes that those of us who preach and teach and minister to each other, and I think that applies to all of us, we need to focus on the word, on words, more explicitly, intentionally, and caringly as part of the practice of our trade. She calls this necessary and urgent activism, and I'm given to agree with her. Also, I want to resist the idea that language is merely an instrument devised and developed by humans to be used and manipulated at will. I want to locate language within God's good creation, and I want to see it clearly for the gift that it is. I'm convinced that human language is radically different from the communication of animals, fish, insects, and birds, and that caring for words, loving them well, and loving well with them is a critical aspect of the good work we are called to do as stewards of God's creation. So I have a lot of reasons for wanting to explore this topic together tonight. And it's my hope that the ideas that I have to offer you here will prove to fortify us for the task of loving words and for the immediate task of discussing together what it might look like to do so. I look forward to hearing from you later this evening. So, where are we going? The Bible has quite a lot to say about the work of the lips and tongue and numerous explicit teachings about the work of our words, be they from lines of poetry, proverbs, prophetic utterance, or pastoral exhortation. And here is a brief sampling. Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. My lips will pour forth praise. My tongue will sing of your word. There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. Whoever guards his mouth preserves his life. He who opens wide his lips comes to ruin. And from the New Testament, the words of Jesus, for out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give account for every careless word they speak. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. And from James' epistle, if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle his whole body. But no human can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth comes blessing and cursing. And in Paul's letter to the Romans, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse them. It is this language of blessing and cursing that I want to pick up on, for I think that in considering what the biblical writers had in mind when they used these words, bless, curse, we will find a very deep well to draw from in thinking about what it means to love and care for words. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. So I'm going to take bless and curse as contrasting possibilities for language and as the organizing concepts for the rest of the lecture, because it is in a far more comprehensive sense, they are the contrasting possibilities for human existence. As you will see, when it comes to the Hebraic understanding of bless and curse, which was undoubtedly behind the New Testament writers' use of the words, what we have is far more than saying nice things or saying mean things. What we have is a matter of giving life or dealing death. with our words. So we will first explore the meanings of bless and curse as pictured for us mainly in the first few chapters of Genesis. And I will offer descriptions of how I see humans cursing with words today and how I see humans blessing with words today. I'm going to look at these two contrasting things, deception versus truth-telling, the cursing way, the blessing way, and terrorizing versus making safe and healing. Again, cursing contrasts with blessing, and then we'll have a discussion. So let me say from the outset that exploring the biblical understanding of bless and curse with an eye toward what this means for how to love words is an effort in translation and cross-cultural communication, both acts, I should note, of language care. When we hear the word bless, when I hear the word bless, I think of what you say when someone sneezes. Or perhaps if I'm thinking a little more deeply, wanting good things for someone, or of speaking kindly to or well of someone. And this is what the Greek word, eulogio, maybe someone can help me with that if they have a better pronunciation, from which we have eulogy, that's what this means, to speak well of, to praise, to flatter, to compliment. And it is this word that is used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament to render the Hebrew word barak, and it is the word that New Testament writers use to speak of blessing to a Greek-speaking audience. But they're using a Greek word to convey a very Hebrew idea. And if we want to get at what it might mean to bless with our words, we must do our best to understand the Hebrew meaning of bless. The verb bless in the Old Testament is designated almost exclusively by barak, and Ephraim Radner notes that etymologically, the meaning of barak is shrouded in mystery. Theories of the root meanings include, theories of the meaning include break into pieces, kneel, and hence adore. God is first to bless, blessing is his to give. And if we are to imagine God blessing as an act of God kneeling to his creation, we see from the very beginning a foreshadowing of the incarnation. God in Jesus is God unequivocally with his creation, powerfully distinct from but scandalously close with us, blessing by kneeling, coming close by humbling himself. Radner further explains that the Hebrew notion of blessing is bound to a very rich theological set of semantic construals. And that is to say, this word is high and long and wide and deep, and it is not easily summarized in a linear fashion. It is best approached, I think, through steeping ourselves in the stories and associations, the family of words and images and ideas that give this term its contours. So we start at the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that it was good. It was good. And God blessed. God speaking, God creating, God seeing goodness, and God blessing come together. Before there is speech, there is a speaker. And the words of the speaker have the power to create. The speaker sees what is created and blesses it sees the inner coherence between what is spoken and what is made, and is pleased. And there's another element to the pattern. On the fifth day, at the culmination of creating sea creatures and birds, God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." And on the sixth day, after making humans, God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply." God speaks, God creates, God sees goodness, God blesses, and this means fruitfulness. Radner summarizes, "Blessing is life created by and from God, a life that gives life and extends life. Blessing is life created by and from God, a life that gives and extends life." Let me put it this way. Blessing is the gift of life given to give life. It is this connection between blessing and life that I want us to remember. So first and foremost, blessing, life, is God's to give and God's to sustain. Let me here say that whatever else it has come to be, existence is first and foremost a gift. This is critical for our concern for words today. Not that it is a new problem. We will see that greedy entitlement competed for thankful humility from the start. But as Marilyn McIntyre observes, the marketing language that dominates descriptions of human interaction in a capitalist economy obscures a much deeper understanding of the gift character of all that is and our familial relationship to all life, and especially to each other. Here I also want to point out the link between blessing and speaking, and God blessed them saying, and God blessed them and God said. And in the retelling of the human creation story in Genesis 5, male and female, he created them, and he blessed them and named them man. Again, in God's covenant with Noah after the flood, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them. And again, and perhaps most profoundly, in God's covenant with Abram, the Lord said, "And I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." This promise of beautifully entangled blessing is the first time we see a human being becoming a blessing, a mediator of God's blessing, at least explicitly. But I would argue that even back in the garden, humans are given the vocation of blessing, the work of blessing, the work of living in God to extend life. And this too is linked with speaking. In the Genesis 2 account of the creation of humans, man is put in the garden to work it and keep it. And it seems that as part of God's creative process of making a creature fit for or corresponding to man, God brings the animals before man to see what he would name them. This is strange to me. Isn't it the artist's job to name his piece of art? Man did not create the beasts and the birds, after all. Why is this work, this naming, part of the working and keeping of the garden? I wonder if the purpose is twofold. First, naming strikes me as an exceedingly parental rite. Could it be that God is delineating for man the character of his dominion by underscoring, in McIntyre's words, the familial relationship of man to the rest of creation? Is God inviting man to, if I may use the theologically weighty term, adopt the rest of creation as his? Is God, to some extent, sharing the divine right to bless, to give and extend life with humans? Second, this naming is done in the context of God recognizing man's aloneness and for the first time declaring it is not good. Through the naming process, man is given the opportunity to recognize this aloneness of kind as well. Naming follows seeing, encountering the other. And for man, this also meant seeing what wasn't. And then, perhaps you know the story, the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and while he slept, took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. And Adam's response, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man." Adam's words strike me as deeply delighted and deeply grateful. Here in this beautiful bit of poetry, we have human words that bless, different than the way God blesses, because Adam's blessing is not linked to creating, but rather to recognizing, bearing witness to the full significance and value of what has been created and by whom she has been created. This is pure speculation, but I imagine man kneeling before the woman, but addressing God, because he uses the third person after all, she, and not the second person, you. These are the words of man receiving the blessing of God and blessing God in return and blessing God's work. A beautifully entangled blessing. This, I think, is the beginning of loving, life-giving speech. Seeing what is and by whom it is, saying yes and thank you, and answering the call to relationship. Blessing is life created by and from God, a life that gives and extends life. Blessing is rich, many-layered, vast, thick. To bless with words is to participate in the life-giving process that God alone sustains. To bless with words is to acknowledge the gift character of all that is, and to remember that our speech is a response to God's speech. God speaks, and his words create, and they create the possibility for relationship. To speak is to enter into relationship with each other, with the rest of creation, with God himself. This is a picture of language that is far from instrumental. This is a picture of the dialogical character of language. Philosopher Craig Gay puts it this way: we human beings are the creatures that God has called into responsibility. We are addressed, called by God, and are able to respond to him. Bless and curse not. If blessing is God creating life and making it thick, adding life to life to life in interconnected layers of sustaining care, the notion of cursing, Ephraim Radner notes, seems to imply thinning out reality, making it light and superfluous, and finally, lifeless. How vivid is this picture of thinning, of wasting away, brings to mind disconnection, fragmentation, shallowness, and facade, a shell-like existence and shell-like words. Speech disconnected from a speaker, words treated as suitcases to be packed with whatever we want them to carry. And this is exactly how speech is used in Genesis 3. in the serpent's deception of Eve. And I'll speak more directly about the cursing nature of deceit later, but for now let's look at the exchange between the serpent and the woman and note the way language is used to unmake. Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God actually say you shall not eat of any tree in the garden?" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" The two words, "actually say," leap out at me as full of incredulity that God could mean what he says. And of course, as the woman rightly points out, God did not actually say what the serpent suggested. But the curse is uttered. God doesn't mean what he says. God doesn't stand by his words. And the power of suggestion hangs heavy. Did I hear God rightly? Did he mean what he said? And then this half-truth, "You will not surely die." The givenness of God's creation, the gift of it, is now presented as just one way of seeing the matter. There are other ways to be in the world, and they might be better than God's way. God doesn't even tell the truth, after all. "You will not surely die." Though the word curse does not appear here, I would argue that what is happening is curse-like. Reality is being thinned out. God's trustworthiness and his faithfulness to his words is radically questioned. And of course, a curse is precisely what ensues. They ate, and their eyes were opened. But rather than a heightened vision of depth and complexity and connectedness, there is nakedness. Craig Gay writes, "Tragically, the serpent managed to deceive our first parents, thereby introducing death, corruption, and the distortion of language into our world. Yet," and this is a big and beautiful yet, "what remains of our world's thickness and consistency is still underwritten by the trustworthiness and faithfulness of the speakers of words." God remains faithful to his word, and though there is distortion of language now, the possibility that we might also be faithful to our words remains. Conversely, Gay continues, "refusing to take words seriously or deceitfully playing with them is still the surest way to confuse and unmake our world." As I said earlier, what we have before us is a matter of giving life or dealing death with our words. What does blessing and cursing with words, giving life or dealing death, look like today? I have paired two examples of cursing and blessing as I see it today, each time beginning with the example of cursing and ending with the example of blessing. So first, deceiving or deception versus truth-telling. And then second, we will look at terrorizing versus making peace and healing with our words. So all the way back in the Garden of Eden, words were used to deceive. "You will not surely die." Perhaps most explicitly, the Hebrew understanding of curse is depicted in deceit, a thinning out of reality, making it light and superfluous and finally lifeless. This is the work of lies, both small and large. To take things for less than they are, or to make them out to be less than they are, to minimize and diminish, to cut off from a life source. And I have come across no better depiction of the work of lying than in Richard Wilbur's poem by that name. And I would be lying to assert that I understand the poem completely. It remains beyond my grasp in all the best ways, drawing me back for read after read after read. But I think I can say that it is a meditation on the way language makes or unmakes, blesses or curses. He writes, "In the strict sense, of course, we invent nothing, merely bearing witness to what each morning brings again to light. I think it is this fact of our createdness, that we are always working with what God made, and that our work is, at beginning and end, to witness what is. It is this fact that Wilbur sees as the reality of creaturehood that so nettled the devil and drove the spite underlying the arch-negators," this is Wilbur's term, "deceit." So a larger excerpt from the poem. "There is what galls the arch-negator, sprung from hell to probe with intellectual sight the cells and heavens of a given world, which he could take but as another prison. Small wonder that, pretending not to be, he drifted through the bar-like bowls of Eden in a black mist, low creeping, dragging down and darkening with moody self-absorption, what, when he left it, lifted, and, if seen from the sun's vantage, seethed with vaulting hues. Closer to making than the deftest fraud is seeing how the catbird's tail was made to counterpoise on the mock orange spray, its light uptilted spine." I'll just mention that bowls was not a word I was familiar with, are tree trunks. Behind deceit is the gall of not being able to make in the way God makes, to create. And so the given world is taken as a prison. Everything that is seen through the black mist of moody self-absorption, and the work is spite, negation, fraud, a thinning out of reality, making it out to be superfluous, lifeless. The curse of deceit is first a failure to see things as they really are, and two, in Wilbur's words, bear witness. So, ways we see this today. Big things. The Volkswagen emissions scandal, which was a blatant act of thinning out reality. The Environmental Protection Agency found that many VW cars being sold in America had devices in diesel engines that could detect when they were being tested, changing the performance accordingly to improve results. The BBC tells me. There we go. All the while, they were advancing a huge marketing campaign trumpeting its cars' low emissions. To their credit, VW has admitted, we might even say confessed, that they totally screwed up and are now urgently working to win back people's trust. This example of deceit serves to depict a familiar problem today. When persons are seen as merely consumers, and this is in the origin of deceit, remember, a failure to look and see things, in this case, people, for what they really are, the moody self-absorption, here, the profiteering agenda, becomes the black mist over a much brighter reality. But deceit is often more subtle than this. We know terms like half-truth, spin, and euphemism, and all of them, I would argue, rely on deliberate imprecision. Marilyn McIntyre notes, "Precision is difficult to achieve. Imprecision is easier. imprecision is available in a wide variety of attractive and user-friendly forms. Clichés, abstractions and generalizations, jargon, passive constructions, hyperbole, sentimentality, and reassuring absolutes. Imprecision is a way in which lying can masquerade as confidence, as tentativeness, sensitivity, even humility. And don't get me wrong, all of those things are critical traits to nurture when they're put in the service of telling the truth. But where they are merely used to blur and blunt precision, there they are agents of deceit. Remember the meaning of curse. Reality is thinned out. Wendell Berry describes language like this as language that is unable to admit what it is talking about. Language that is unable to admit what it is talking about. Political discourse is perhaps most infamous for this, especially language used around war. Phrases like collateral damage and enhanced interrogation program obscure the realities to which they refer. Accidentally killing civilians and torture. George Orwell said, "When certain topics are raised, the concrete melts into the abstract." But this is not only true in regard to politics and war. It is also true of the treacherous linguistic terrain of DTRs, or RDTs, defining the relationship talk, or relationship defining talk, depending on how you learned this. And on the other end, breakup conversations. The personal vulnerability and risk required to be frank, clear, and direct in moments like this is a risk too great to take for many would-be wooers, and the result is confusion. I need a couple little hearts up here that I'm filling out. Joshua gave me permission to share a story about a phone conversation that he had in college with a female friend. A conversation he later learned, to his surprise and dismay, that established a dating relationship between the two of them. But whether the misunderstanding was due to the girl's vagueness or imprecision, or to Joshua's denseness, he might say it was the latter. I cannot say for sure. But you have to know the rest of the story. And it is that the second he hung up the phone, his roommate, who was an international student and ESL speaker, said, "What just happened?" To which Joshua replied, "Oh, nothing." "No," his roommate insisted, "you're dating." So maybe that sort of undermines this as an example. It was very clear, very precise to Shinji from Japan, I think, yeah. For myself, I didn't tell you I was going to include this one, I think of an interminable breakup conversation, also with Joshua, but that story has a happier ending. Here we are. Made so interminably long, I realize now, in large part, because Wendell Berry got it right. We were using language that was unable to admit what it was talking about. And perhaps these occasions are the most excruciating because it feels that blessing and curse is hanging in the balance. Will a relationship be born? Will a relationship die? So, three ways that we might bless by telling the truth. Bearing witness, disciplining ourselves toward precision, and refusing to tolerate lies. Remember the words from Richard Wilbur's poem. In the strict sense, of course, we invent nothing, merely bearing witness to what each morning brings again to light. This is at once maddeningly basic and dauntingly lofty. To bend our full faculties toward what is, to perceive well. This involves close and patient observation, attentive listening, and the humility to upfront our own limitations. This posture of bearing witness is prerequisite to the work of precision and to the task of resisting lies. This is a posture to take before God, each other, and creation, and this work of witnessing, of perceiving, must come before the work of speaking. It is worth noting that all too often construals of witnessing to others about the Christian faith means firstly and only talking to them or at them about Christianity, completely neglecting this critical prerequisite of perceiving. So to tell the truth, we must first bear witness to what each morning brings again to light. And when words are spoken, we love them by attending to them. To riff on Wilbur's line, we invent nothing, merely bearing witness to what each speaker speaks, to get it right. To love words and to love with words means we attend to the ways the word is used, not merely to some notion of how it should be used. It means humbly inquiring what the user of the word means and then listening. It is worth highlighting here that loving words through bearing witness means loving silence and its vital relationship to truth hearing and truth telling. Earlier, I described the cursing nature of deliberate imprecision, using words to blur and conceal, to thin out reality. There is also the imprecision that comes from mere incompetence. And so to discipline ourselves toward precision is both to aim for whatever our level of competence may be, clarity and transparency of speech, as well as to bear witness to the fact that reality is thick. At some point, words do falter and fall silent before the truth of which they aim to tell. But there is a long distance that words can go, and most of us, myself included, are more often guilty of giving up on them too soon. I like what Marilyn McIntyre says of the demands of truth-telling. It is something like an extreme sport for the very committed. The weather is never predictable, and there is always an undertow. We learn gradually from those who do it well how to tolerate the intolerable wrestle with words and meanings, as Eliot put it, and even to delight in it. When it comes to resisting deliberate imprecision and other cursing deceptions, we must begin, I'm afraid, by resisting our own preference to be deceived. And again here, Marilyn McIntyre writes very perceptively, "Indeed, we bear a heavy responsibility for allowing ourselves to be lied to." She quotes Pascal's observation, offered long before the age of media spin. We hate the truth, and people hide it from us. We want to be flattered, and people flatter us. We like being deceived, and we are deceived. Piercingly, McIntyre lists what seem to be the deceptions we especially like today, those that comfort, insulate, legitimate, and provide ready excuses for inaction. Calling those who lie to account begins first by calling ourselves to account for our tolerance of or our passivity toward lies. For words to give life, to bless with words, there must be a speaker behind what is spoken, and there must be a hearer whose involved listening and perceiving holds the speaker accountable. Herein lies the heart of the problem. We expect to be lied to, and so we are cynical. We want to be lied to, and so we are passive. But loving and caring for words and choosing to bless rather than to curse with them means to seek truth and to hold those in leadership to account for their words. McIntyre lists what this includes: clarifying where there is confusion, naming where there is evasion, correcting where there is error, fine-tuning where there is imprecision, satirizing where there is folly, changing the terms when the terms falsify. These are numerous and complex responsibilities, and not one of us can fulfill them alone. We need each other's help. We know well enough it is not good for us to be alone. Helpers are needed indeed. The next pairing, cursing and blessing, I want to look at is terrorizing speech versus speech that makes safe and heals. A couple weeks ago, the BBC carried an article about a Syrian Catholic priest who had been kidnapped by ISIS, held for 3 months, and regularly threatened with execution. Father Jack Murad said of his captivity, "We were well fed, given medical treatment, and never tortured. What stood out was the verbal abuse." He expounded, "For them, my fate for refusing to convert to Islam was death. To frighten us, they would even tell us in detail how we would die. They are truly gifted at using words and imagery to terrorize." The article caught my eye because he wasn't killed, which I think is amazing. And I should be very clear that obviously ISIS uses many other means of terrorizing than words. And of course, the Islamic State is not the first or the only military body to use words, among many other things, to terrorize. The verbal aggressions, among other horrors, of Nazi Germany are well documented. Words that strike fear, manipulate, taunt, and threaten are perhaps most noticeable and most appalling to us when they are spoken by those acting on the global stage with widespread impact. But any of us with school-aged children, and all of us having survived playground and school hall power struggles and lived to tell the tale, can attest to the fact that words are where terrorizing, where bullying begins. The adage, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me," has it exactly wrong. Craig Gay notes, "Indeed, words can crush our spirits more efficiently and effectively than perhaps any other single agency." And Solomon observed, "A man's spirit will endure sickness, but a crushed spirit, who can bear?" So it is not too great a leap to assert with Marilyn McIntyre, who answered a hapless economics major condemned by general education requirements to take her poetry course, when she asked, "Why do people study poems?" Marilyn McIntyre said, "I can't think of many things that are more useful than this. Language is the basic tool for preserving civilization. It's arguably one of the most potent forms of power that society has produced. Language is the basic tool for dismantling a civilization, for dismantling a person. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and terrorizing language is perhaps the most blatantly deathly of all. One way of responding to the power of language to terrorize in small and large ways is described in the title article of the September issue of The Atlantic, Better Watch What You Say, The Coddling of the American Mind. And it's by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt. And it takes a critical look at the priority placed in colleges and universities across the country on protecting students from words and ideas they don't like. Words and ideas that trigger or offend them. The trend basically amounts to policing language in the name of protecting students' emotional well-being. Microaggressions, small actions or word choices that seem on their face to have no malicious intent, but that are thought of as a kind of violence nonetheless, are condemned. An example of this being the question, "Where were you born?" to someone of Asian or Latino American descent, the subtext of the question being, "You're not a real American." Professors are also expected to provide trigger warnings before assigning course content, books like Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart or Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby are noted, books that carry the potential to re-traumatize students who have experienced, for example, racism or domestic violence in the past. This movement takes very seriously the potential for words to enact violence, for words to terrorize. But I cite it here as a negative example of example of a cultural response to this reality that words do hurt more than sticks and stones. As Lukianoff and Haidt convincingly show, this policing of speech and of a type of censorship is doing no one a great service. And it is, in fact, perpetuating and deepening pathological patterns of thinking in students. I want to say that to counter the curse of terrorizing violent speech, we must learn to bless with language that makes safe and heals, not, on the one hand, attempt to create a language bubble around emerging adults, or on the other hand, go on verbal witch hunts. This response, as I see it, loses the forest for the trees. Though it does, I think, evidence our desperation to hold people accountable to their words, for their words. Yet it only serves to perpetuate a culture of fear and paranoia in precisely the location, the university, where students should be learning how to use language to strip this kind of fear and paranoia of its power. Add to this Marilyn McIntyre's observation that students expect to be lied to, and we have, in the words of one of my colleagues, one hot mess. In contrast to the cursing power of terrorizing words and this policing approach, I will consider here three ways of blessing with words that can make safe and heal. I forgot to put that up. Staying in conversation, even when it is hard. Speaking peace and cherishing silence. I'm going to pop back to here. Yeah. In their article, Lukianoff and Haidt ask the question, what are we doing to our students if we encourage them to develop extra thin skin in the years just before they leave the cocoon of adult protection and enter the workforce? Would they not be better prepared to flourish if we taught them to question their own emotional reactions and to give people the benefit of the doubt? In short, I would answer them, yes. One key way to do this, I believe, is through modeling and teaching the art of conversation and building in students the emotional and mental reserves to stay in conversation especially with people they don't agree with. So, conversation seems obvious, but it's critical, is only possible between persons. The first blessing conversation offers is the recognition that you and I are persons, and we are the ones behind our words. This presupposes respect and a measure of grace from the outset. Conversation has been called the process of coming to an understanding. And Craig Gay notes, at the end of the day, the words that really make coming to an understanding possible for us are those that are spoken genuinely and truthfully. Our words only become solid and dependable insofar as we have committed ourselves to standing behind them. There is nothing of conversation in bullying, abusing, and terrorizing with words. There is no speech with, there are only words hurled at. The conversation pursued deliberately, honestly, with genuine curiosity, and with great effort to hear what exactly the other person is saying, is truly a way to bless and give life with our words. Not only does genuine, sustained conversation create a safe space to come to an understanding, it is also an essential component in healing and reconciliation. Pleasant words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. Perhaps we have not terrorized or bullied with our words, but I would bet that we have all hurt with our words. And so the work of confessing wrong, asking forgiveness, and seeking to heal wounds we have inflicted with words, with new healing words, is a way of blessing that we must all cultivate. We may also have some serious listening to do in conversations like this. We may be held to further account for our words. And this is deeply humbling work, but it is the way of blessing. Remember Jesus' words, "Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks." Words are our primary means of showing a change of heart, and it is a gift that we are able to do so. Akin to this work of reconciling and healing conversations is the possibility of blessing with words by speaking peace to one another. In Psalm 85, the psalmist longs to hear the Lord's voice. "Let me hear what God the Lord will speak, for he will speak peace to his people, to his saints." He will speak peace. To speak peace is to impart life-giving speech that powerfully contradicts and undoes the cursing of words that terrorize. The simple absence of the word "of" here unites the action of speaking with what is spoken. We do not read "speak of peace." This kind of speech is not a cerebral reasoning about peace. This is peace itself, spoken and imparted. In a short meditation on this psalm, Marilyn McIntyre notes that if we are to speak peace, our speaking must be an extension of prayer. And I think she's exactly right. And for those of us who worship in a liturgical setting, the location of the passing of the peace reflects this order. We confess, we are reminded of God's forgiveness and declared free from our sin, and extended God's peace. And then we're invited to extend the peace to one another. It takes hearing God the Lord speak peace into our anxiety, into our heartache, and into our fears for us to be able to speak peace that is true peace to others. And then Speaking peace might take the shape of words that provide a new angle on a difficult circumstance, or words that open a hidden door where there seemed to be a dead end in our thinking, or words that simply allow pause and quiet and space to believe that there may be alternatives to our way of seeing things. As a final example and in conclusion of how we might love words and bless with them, I want to look at the importance of silence. I mentioned the importance of listening well in conversation, and this is one place for silence. But I am also thinking of the need for silence as a deliberate counter to the glut of words and sound constantly surrounding us. McIntyre writes, "Noise insulates us from the silence that exposes us to encounter with self and God, and the voice of the Spirit that groans within us in ways we may not control. To choose silence is to risk that encounter." I will add to her encounters with self and God, encounters with others. Anyone who has, like me, boarded a plane, found your seat, popped in headphones, and pulled out a book, and hunched down low in your seat, you know exactly how to send the message that you do not want to encounter your neighbor. And to not have headphones, to be bookless, to not be surrounded by words, but rather silence, leaves one vulnerable to encounter the person sitting beside you. But the silence that I think McIntyre is getting at is one that reminds us that language, what language is for in the first place. It is for relationship with one another and with God. It is for blessing and not cursing. It is for participating in and preserving a thick reality, life given for the giving of life, not for thinning out reality, making light and superfluous and finally lifeless. But this vision for language, and certainly this use of language, requires that we remember that before we were speakers, we were spoken to. Before we could bless, we were blessed. And it takes silence for us to continue to hear the words of the one who made all things. That is where I am going to leave off. I'm going to stand here by my words and invite yours to think together about anything I raised and anything I didn't raise that you would like to bring up. Yeah.
I just want to say thank you. This was wonderful. What brought me up here from Hartford was the title, and I saw the title and I said, this title could go in so many different ways, all of which are interesting to me, and that brought me up here, and I'm not at all disappointed.
Thank you. And your name?
Brian.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming. And you're right. I didn't know which direction it would go when I wrote the title, so I figured thoughts on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And lots of different things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Abigail.
In my favorite novel about Hideous Strength by C.S. Lewis, there's a sequence where the PR guy for the Evil Academy loses his power of speech. And it's very much like Saruman's last words. And it's the idea that they've been lying so much that they stop making sense. The words no longer mean anything.
Yeah.
How would you describe that within the framework of your talk?
To lie so much that there's just a complete loss of meaning that dissolves into silence?
Well, it dissolves into babble.
Babble. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're saying things that are mm-hmm. supposed to mean things, but they're cliches that mean mm-hmm. so much. They mm-hmm. walk, like, they're getting mixed metaphors or
yeah.
things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Kind of like Wendell
yeah.
Berry. Mm-hmm. Wendell Berry said, mm-hmm. I was
mm-hmm.
the ending yeah. around, mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's, the next step is madness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
just like that they lose mm-hmm. their language and then they lose their mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my first thought is that what they've lost probably even before they've dissolved into Babel is a sense that words come from someone and that words actually have a ground of meaning. And I am not well-versed in philosophy of language, and I think there are others here who are, but I'll point out this little book. Oops. Some of you may enjoy having a look at Craig Gay's book that I quoted from a few times. Here it is. It's called Dialogue, Catalog, Monologue, Personal, Impersonal, and Depersonalizing Ways to Use Words. And he makes the sustained argument and then ultimately gives a theology of dialogue. And he makes a comment that, you know, those who would question that God is, he says, thankfully they're wrong. So, you know, he's coming at language from the conviction that language comes from somewhere. And so I think what we're left with if we don't have that is a devolving into Babel. And I think silence relates to it too, to be filling space with Babel so that we can avoid things. But others maybe have thoughts on this or other things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also on the space trilogy, what happened with Joshua's Japanese-speaking friend, mm-hmm. I think, is similar to what happened in Out of the Silent Planet, where Ransom was translating while mm-hmm. the bad guy was explaining things in fine-sounding weasel words, and mm-hmm. Ransom, in his inability to speak the Martian language mm-hmm. fluently, just had to let it mm-hmm. be exactly what it was mm-hmm. in reality. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe just missing the subtlety
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
opens up what's really going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm teaching Paralandra right now. Just mm-hmm. There's this wonderful scene where, in her total innocence, you know, and Westman is trying mm-hmm. to tempt mm-hmm. the woman to
yeah.
want to not be content, to mm-hmm. find ways.
Yep.
How could anybody fall into sin who lived in such perfect contentment?
Mm-hmm.
And she's also puzzled by Ransom just filling space with words. Mm-hmm. She says, why do you people say so much? But she calls, she has a wonderful metaphor. some of the things that Weston's promising her. She says, it's like a tree without fruit and a fruit without taste. There's no mm-hmm. resonance. There's mm-hmm. nothing. It's just
empty. Yeah. Yeah. mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thinking about it in mm-hmm. psychological terms, living in denial of, you know, a stronghold of sin or something. It can be maddening because all of their internal language dances around reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's like mm-hmm. jazz thing. So if you mm-hmm. don't get to melody, you just dance.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In your thinking about this at all, I mean, the first thing that came to my mind when you talk about blessings and curses was just God's covenant making, you know, throughout, and then giving the blessings and the curses, and I don't know, it just makes me think of that, and the blessings that come with faithfulness. To this covenant relationship that God establishes, and then the curses, the disintegration that comes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you know, even just spending time in the first few chapters of Genesis, what struck me again was, or maybe even for the first time, really struck me that. When Adam and Eve choose deceit rather than truth, when they fall, God doesn't revoke their vocation. He doesn't take away the work that He's given them to do. He doesn't take away their capacity to bless. You know, and I think, wow, what a good parent, you know, like the temptation to be like, you don't know how to use that, give that back. We'll wait until you're ready for that, you know. He doesn't. He continues to give humans. He blesses them. And a couple weeks ago at our hospitality weekend, Ben meditated on this as well, and he pointed out God makes clothes for them. This really merciful act of provision, even though they have cut themselves off from life in some way. And I've also been thinking about the whole of Scripture is God's faithfulness to His words, standing by His words, being the one who will be held accountable for what He said, and to the point of embodying it, embodying the word. So, yes, and covenantal, the language,
And just to follow on that a little bit, in our own call to, as you said, to, for example, stay in conversation. And that, not just when you get tired of it or you get sick of getting nowhere or whatever, but and Jesus says, even as, when you're persecuted, bless and do not curse. You know, that's sticking with it. And that's being faithful to this relationship. The respect and honor that the person deserves as being God, you know, in spite of
I didn't develop it fully, but you know, just in thinking about the article in the Atlantic, and I didn't include this either, but they talk about you know, what is there's a time of year, it's like called the uninviting or something, when colleges put out invitations to the speakers of renown that they will have come and speak at college commencements. But then there's, I forget the term, but then students will boycott, protest. Well, we don't want that person because we don't like, you know, what they think about X, Y, and Z. And so they're uninvited to the college. And the observation that they make, which I think is spot on, is if we, you know, essentially throw the baby out with the bathwater. I don't like this about what they think, so they have nothing good to say to me. You know, just complete dismissal of a person and of the possibility that just because you're not in the same camp on whatever issue, they might still have a way of blessing you. So I mean, I find that challenging. And I think it's a challenge to resist stereotyping at every turn.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's kind of going, well, it's definitely related, but as an English teacher, preaching teenagers, what troubles me is to have to stay in the conversation and to be precise. You have to learn words, and there needs to be just a vocabulary and a wealth of vocabulary and a growing wealth of vocabulary. Mm-hmm. It seems that the direction in our culture, especially for kids who spend as much time as they do with kind of quick messaging tools, that there is actually a loss of vocabulary, and a loss of just the words to use to do these things.
Yeah.
That they're stutterers, that they're, they don't have the words to do this.
Yeah.
That's my burden.
For
kids.
Yeah.
This age.
Connected to that, I was just thinking, she gave the example of, I can't remember which book it was, from the Space Trilogy, and the idea of language sort of disintegrating to balance. I was thinking the opposite, because this is where my head is from my talk this morning, is that for young children, babbling is a good stage. As far as speech and language development, there is a place where you want a child to move into babbling, and then from there. And so just thinking of speech and language development is a progression up into more accuracy as far as sound and words. And I find that very often older toddlers and preschoolers, sometimes their language is actually more accurate, like what they call things. They don't actually name things. So there is actually a precision to their language. But I'm just wondering, kind of tacked on to what Lenny said, I just have been sitting here thinking about that as you've been talking, and I wonder, like, where's the tipping point? Because very young children, I mean, from birth to 3, 4, 5, are on an uphill trajectory in a really positive way.
And it's so fun when a word has more than one meaning.
And the way they start playing with humor and abstract language and rhyming and sound and can really get into that. But then there is at some point a decent
conversion.
But I don't know. There has to be the tipping point. I think the tipping point is when the peer absorption sets in to the extent, or that they're not surrounded enough with enough language, that they're not sitting at a dinner table listening to adult conversation,
reading books, or
if they're spending all of their time just texting friends and with this kind of really, really basic
language,
light, hardly language, that there's nothing else going in.
So what do you think, what do you suggest we do?
It'll talk in itself, but I gave it yesterday to a mom's group. I think family's key, and I think you have to be really, really intentional, not to be negative, but to have lots of alternatives that involve real people and real contact and real talking and real conversation. And that they love it when they're young. Mm-hmm. So set the pattern. Patterns going then. The read aloud, and read aloud can go on. You can read aloud to preteens and teens. Mm-hmm. You can do it. You can keep it going. I've been in families, and I know families that do it. I just know that when they give up, Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just, you know, the bedroom becomes a command center for all the media stuff, mm-hmm. and they're just biding their time to get back there where they can check mm-hmm. in and see who's talking about mm-hmm. what, mm-hmm. whether they're being talked about.
Yeah.
Then you've lost.
Yeah.
At that point, I mean, you probably, but it's just mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. really hard to kind of recapture.
Yeah.
But it's harder still because typical parents. I mean, I work in a school district too. I see them all the time come in with their kids. They're waiting to be seen with their kids.
And they're
they're connected mm-hmm. to their phone, not to their kid, even though their kid's right in front of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that probably happens in the home as well.
Modeling.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's shifting gears a bit, but I'd love you to sort of expand a little bit more on what you mean by deception being thinning mm-hmm. of reality. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, it was reminding me of something Miroslav Volf wrote that Dick and I heard him on an interview when we were in Vermont. Really interesting about, he made this thing for me, thick religion and thin religion. And mm-hmm. thin religion is what is able to be abused by political extremist groups. Thick religion, not so much. Thick mm-hmm. theology, mm-hmm. but it's thin mm-hmm. religion, which can take slogans and take the mm-hmm. law and mm-hmm. really deceptive ways, you know,
yeah.
in the name of Christianity or Islam or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly,
mm-hmm.
certainly in the name of Christianity. But I love mm-hmm. it, and that's. That was just something that came to my mind because it's a thick and thin.
Yeah.
But I'd love to, you know, yep. to understand better what exactly what you meant by that.
Yeah.
Started about in Genesis and then
mm-hmm. The main reason that I used thinning was because of a definition of curse, and so looking at bless and curse not, and so, well, what does it mean to bless? What does it mean to curse? And that kind of the associated concepts and images and ideas around the Hebrew word of curse imply thinning out, famine. The things that you see that come of cursed lands, land that doesn't yield, and so fruitlessness. It's the contrast of blessing, be fruitful, multiply. Yeah. So, I think I'm sure there was a very connected pattern of thought for me as I worked through this and thought, like, wow, deceit is kind of the one that seems to epitomize that thinning. For my thinking, I think it really went back to that poem by Richard Wilbur, where he depicts Satan as the one who doesn't see Eden for what it is. So his perception is to see it. He probes it, for one. And, you know, the cells and heavens, I take that as, like, both the microscopic and the macroscopic of a given world. You know, he takes it as but another prison. And so to be self-deceived, I guess, is to fail to see things for what they really are. And to be cut off from what really is going to be the path of cursing, that
arch famine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Negating, affirming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Things that get
undoing.
Then become transparent, and then you can just see through them, so they're not there.
Mm-hmm. I kept thinking of Lewis's imagery in The Great Divorce and the need to become more and more solid.
I read an article on a plane, so I'm sorry I can't give a reference.
It's okay.
It was a scientific study where they took a bunch of people. They all had an experience together. Half the group they took and they exposed them to stories of their experience that were lies.
Mm-hmm.
And half the group they expose us to stories of that weren't lies. And they found that even though people, and they would come back and relate the story at different times, and even the people who were truthful when they first saw the experience and related to it, later after they heard the lie story, the different accounts of it, they started not remembering what had actually happened. Even though it was all recorded. They started falling in line with the story that was the lie, because they started doubting themselves or something. But it was this weird mnemonic scientific way how the mind works. That if you hear a different account, it's only a few people will stick to their story. Especially with the social context where they were trying to be part of a group, where they were punished for not being part of the group. I think that was part of the vague thing, but it seems to be linked to memory.
Well, I was thinking, you know, how Israel is commanded to remember, and that theme of remembering throughout Scripture is critical, because we are absolutely prone to forgetting and distorting the truth of a reality that was, you know, as we gain distance from it. So I, you know, to kind of link even what Lenny was saying about, you know, what can families do, I was thinking about the place of telling stories and the real need to be storied people, and for kids to grow up both with a sense of the big story that they're part of, story of Scripture, but then for the dinner table or wherever it is, bedtime, you know, to be a place where stories of the day are shared, and that there's interest taken, and even the discipline of remembering my day, what happened in my day, and reflecting on it. But,
I was just wondering, thank you very much, slightly different direction, but if you, in thinking of us, ran across any questions about the difficulty of discerning between blessing and cursing, the first thing that comes to my mind is Abraham taking, if we're thinking of blessing as giving life and cursing as dealing with death, so Abraham being asked to take Isaac to Mount Moriah, and then, you know, Kierkegaardian reflection on this, fear and trembling. The moment of sort of raising a knife and then hearing the voice of God. And so you have this seeming conflict between what's been commanded. Elie Wiesel sort of ruminates on, well, how does he know that this second hearing isn't just a projection of something that he wants, right? Something that he would prefer, this form of life. Even if, rather than this kind of sacrifice. And the difficulty in some sense of discerning this when the command has been, in some sense, death. And then life just comes out. But, and I guess some of the other things that come to mind would be the disciples' continued failure to hear well, or to hear properly underneath what's being said, the message being given to them, being too concerned with the present negative consequences.
That's a great question, and I didn't come across anything, you know, specific to that. But what comes to mind in the Abraham account, sounds like Elie Wiesel's reflections on it. It strikes me that there's sort of a perfect tension between trusting the words that were spoken, the commands that were given, and trusting the one who gave them, and maybe even more so, knowing that voice so well. And I think that is very much at the heart of a lot of this, is discerning the voice of truth, the voice of the truth speaker, knowing the character of that.
Hebrews tells you more than Genesis does. And faith is not just a feeling.
Trust.
It's Mm-hmm. That even if he died, he'd be raised back alive. Mm-hmm. Because there was another word that said, a son from your own flesh.
Right, that's what I was thinking. Like, I mean,
yeah.
I've always been troubled by that passage. Like, awful. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine being in that position. You know?
The fear here in reflection of that, then fear and trembling is that faith is what he calls absurd. There's no, and he's saying he's with a positive light onto that, but that he can't grasp it's not in a discourse that's typically available to him. It goes beyond the manner in which we typically understand that kind of speech. Because it asks him to believe in something that isn't seemingly impossible. The words are sort of speaking beyond himself.
I think that sometimes we can take that in a direction that is not given as a normal moral dilemma. The Abraham Isaac sequence is as I understand it anyway, and I think Kirk ultimately did. He's playing all sorts of games with the ultimate version of it, but is giving you a picture of the horror that you're meant to experience, and he was meant to experience, because you're getting a picture of the father sacrificing the son, which is everything going wrong. This is the whole symphony collapsing and bashing each other over the head with their instruments. Mm-hmm. Music stops and everything's ruined. Everything goes wrong. Mm-hmm. So that's a picture. We're meant to experience an emotional chaos in that, I think. Mm-hmm. And as we revolt at it, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. Because you're getting a picture of the father sacrificing his son. Mm-hmm. And we're meant to experience horror in that, and revulsion at that. And how could this possibly be? Because of what it says, really, about where here's poor Abraham is asked to play the part of God in a drama that is to come. And so, I guess I just.
When he stopped.
We're meant to be horrified rather than say, oh, that's cool. If we just hear the voice of God, it'll be okay, and it'll be all right. I think that's true, but the reality of the transaction is we're meant to be horrified, and we ought to be horrified, and because of of the overall picture of what that represents in the big story of the Bible. So, I guess what I'm just saying is that isn't a normal moral dilemma that comes along and we have trouble finding blessing from curse. This is a huge, absolutely unique event where a poor human being is asked to play the role of the father in a drama in his own life, with the father taking his only son and giving up his only son, which is to do what God did. God so loved the world that.
Yeah, just you know, getting back to maybe I think what was part of your what I took as a thrust of your question of just discerning, because sometimes it's hard to discern what is blessing or curse, but then maybe applying that to how do we bless others. And I was trying to remember an article that I read just recently about the importance of, or this sort of rediscovery of blessing and the importance of it. What comes to mind is really listening to a person and trying to see what they are seeing or not seeing, what is the truth behind this, and then speaking words that can bring that truth to bear. And I think that's really just sort of the essence of love. This really is giving yourself to the other and really trying to understand them, and then speaking the truth in love to them is a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
That's for distinguishing between his cursors and what's in.
Hannah?
Yeah, I was actually going to ask kind of for you to speak a little bit more about that, about truth-telling, and I think I think it's such a difficult thing to discern, I think, because it's not just speaking what is true. And I just wondered if you could say a little bit more about how to bless while speaking the truth, because I feel like speaking the truth is not always a blessing. I just wondered if you could speak a little bit about how to kind of balance that. Is there a place for sort of this sensitive language? Is it dancing around like
Do you have an instance, a specific instance in mind that you'd be willing to? Okay. not to just dodge that, but I do think that the particulars of a situation are significant, you know, in how to speak truth into things. But I think to expect to be odd, I think, is it, Joe, you might know this. Oh, did he just leave? Oh, I think Flannery O'Connor said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you odd." Right? Yeah. So strange shall make you strange. So I think there is a place for being ready to be weird, for speaking truth, or even asserting that there might be such a thing. I don't know. Do others have thoughts on that? Yeah.
Truth as fact. A zillion examples where that can be highly destructive, and ruinous relationally and so on. And we talked about the wonderful verse in Ephesians 4, which talks about, "Let no evil talk come out of your mouth, but only such as is good for edifying, as fits the occasion, and that imparts grace to those who hear." Now, that's an amazing set of criteria. It's not just truth, but it's got to fit the occasion. And let's think of all the different times when saying the facts that are factually true is totally unfitting to the occasion. So part of telling the truth in a blessing way is a huge level of sensitivity to what's going on, to who you're talking to, where they are, what's happening, as well as the other criteria, to be upbuilding and to impart grace. That's a huge load to take on.
But even when you're doing exactly what he says, if someone doesn't want to hear what you're saying, they can become your enemy. So expect persecution for speaking the truth. And loss of friendship sometimes. Even when you're being very gentle, if they don't want to hear it, they won't hear it as being gentle. It will make it into something that they would prefer.
And this sounds like an instance where, you know, how do we tell the truth while staying in conversation? Because I think often there are situations where it's a long haul endeavor, and it's multiple conversations, and it's
over
time and years, and being willing, I think, to be honest about our own limitations too. In the midst of it.
You're just, you know, the question just made me think of a proverb that I had to look up on my phone because I don't totally memorize. But it says, "The wounds of a friend are more trustworthy than like an enemy will multiply kisses," something to that effect. That means I don't know. I think I agree with that. There's particular instances of this. But I can think of a few people in my life who said very difficult things that were the last thing I wanted to hear, especially at the moment, and were probably not easy for them to say, but I'm really glad that it was said, because ultimately it bore fruit. I was able to, they were right, even though they were sensitive, but it's hard. Then I've also had people who are really quick to give me their opinion on any number of things like that I perceive as a hard word, but for them aren't a hard word. They're not a friend. It doesn't come from a, I don't know, a trusted relationship. They're just people who are very quick to give their opinion on anything. And those, I don't know, sometimes those are really not productive. But anyway, how helpful is it for me to have a few people that will speak harsh words that are actually a blessing? Maybe not immediately, but eventually.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a meaning that I came across a few years ago about blessing being given to give responsibility. And I really never thought about it like that. I always thought about it as just my experience. But it really changed the way I thought about blessing. And I think it relates to this question of how can you tell the truth in love? I feel that if the goal is to affirm someone to the extent where he takes up his goal in love for us again, then you bless that person to pursue sort of his life goal. And sometimes people get, you know, lied to and discouraged to the extent where they don't live out what they were meant to live out. And then you bless them, right? You know you have something to live for, so get back in your feet and do it.
That's great.
There are people, and I have to say this with great sorrow, who are incapable of conversation. They're so far into their world of lies and denial that every conversation they have, they've already thought out what the other person is going to react. It follows the script in their own mind, and no amount of conversation, except by the grace of God, can break through. And I fear for this kind of generation, for our kids growing up, because you learn conversation by being loved and being treated as a person that you have a conversation with, instead of as a script in a TV show. And if my generation who has the kids are not teaching that, I fear for the next generation how many people are incapable of conversation. And I'm hoping that their interactions with other people will be according to the script in their mind.
Yeah, it's not scripted. And yeah, to be true to the nature of language and the profound freedom that we have with it. There really are endless possibilities of what we can say.
We're made in the image of God, and something you have said after the lecture, and that God can take away their ability, their vocation with words. And I'm thinking that it's an image of God that we use words to thicken reality, to keep reality firm in what it is. So it's especially the first corruption in the Bible is when Satan creates that doubt by using language, which you brought out mostly. But then when you had said that, other thing that surprised me that God didn't take it away, I started thinking, I'm not so sure that would be thinning it too, wouldn't it? That would be thinning what he did. That would be deceptive.
So that we have language is part of the way we bear the image of God.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been wondering about that too, mm-hmm. thinking that. I think that that's true. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I was just thinking, tied in this question, something small, but I'm just listening to you talk and thinking about your definition of blessing. I'm having to, like, separate myself from the way that word is just thrown around.
Blessing.
In the church and outside of, you know, yeah. be blessed today, bless you, but, you know, I'm from the South, bless your heart, I'm
going
to bless your heart. Yeah. And the idea of the, the definition in the biblical root that you're giving for blessing is positive, but I'm just trying to take a step back off of this sort of fuzzy, warm and fuzzy connotation we have in thinking about Hannah's question. That and this isn't an easy answer, but I think sometimes blessing can be we can our words can be a blessing in the definition that Sarah gave, in that they can be. They can bring life and build up, but it doesn't always feel good. And that's Joshua's point too. I think that that because it feels hard in the moment, I think of that image of iron sharpening iron. It's a
marked
painful, you know, image. And so I'm just in my own head. Like just as we talk, I have to keep sort of checking this kind of warm, fuzzy connotation of blessing. God bless America. You know that we. I think is deeply rooted for those of us who live here. It's just in the vernacular and and how the definition that we're talking about here is good and positive in that way, but not in the fluffy, fuzzy.
Yeah. And if though it is shrouded in etymological mystery, if there is something to blessing being connected to kneeling. Like that humility, you know, to bless both, I think, like to come close. And so often I think it's easy if we feel like we have to say a hard truth to back away from and deliver it. But, you know, what would it look like to come close and even kneel, whatever that metaphorically kneel, maybe physically. In blessing someone in that way. Yeah, it's...
Yeah.
I'm glad you said that, because I kept thinking, like, God bless America, bless God, bless you, like all these different...
Yeah.
Yeah, Sue.
I still find it very confusing to think of how we bless God. What does that actually mean?
Yeah.
Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all those I can easily see the reverse.
It seems, I don't know, there's anybody who has studied Hebrew, Mr. Kay?
I think it's close. I think it's very close.
Yeah, I would say, you know, again, going back to these mysterious meanings, if there's kneeling, adoring, connected with a sense of blessing, I think that it is very much linked with worship. Living worshipfully toward
bearing witness
God.
To who he actually is.
Yeah.
And in Amber's definition, it's an acknowledgement of his dominion.
Yeah.
And his, you don't think about God's responsibility so much, but it is his dominion and acknowledging who he actually is.
I love what you said in the very beginning, being sort of observed. That sort of a foreshadow of this of Christ coming, of God Himself coming, revealing His creation. It's just this
Yeah.
Incredible flip flop.
Mm-hmm.
Really a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
There was another phrase there about breaking in pieces.
I don't know. I wonder. I wonder about that too.
Well, it's fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, no, just that slide.
Oh yeah.
My impression with that was, I mean, I do a lot of writing, and my best writing is when it's when I break my characters into pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's on their heart spills out. And that's my best writing. And I'm wondering why do I have to write with such pain to write well?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if it's because like showing heart is a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with being truthful.
Mm-hmm.
And not hiding yourself behind. Yeah, not hiding yourself behind a facade or anything, behind a throne.
I don't know because it's so physical. I don't know. I would love to look at kind of more of an expanded Hebrew dictionary or something.
People have done a lot of work to take every word that we can see, every meaning of a word that we can see, and invest all those different meanings into every instance of the word.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we understood it ritually, we pile all these meanings, which in fact, maybe the author at any one time had just one of those in mind.
Yeah.
Like the annotated Bible will give you about 5 or 6 meanings for Greek words that are Hebrew.
And
scholars have attacked that, attacked the use that it comes to. So we must admit that if we're really rich in our appreciation of language, we'll load all those meanings onto every other piece, which is sometimes really possible.
That's helpful. Yeah.
There was a little thing I saw on the internet just this week. Moise Silva, the biblical commentator, did a thing. He took a very mundane 20th century, text, and then he projected it like 2,000 years in the future, and scholars were tearing it apart, just showing how, they're giving all these meanings and making it much more complicated than it was really just somebody talking normal.
Well, thank you all for your engagement.